Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode contains distressing themes and descriptions of violence. This podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener caution is advised. It was around 8 a.m. on February 23rd, 1968, when a man walked down a service lane behind Carmichael Place in Glasgow. Every exhale immediately condensed into a cloud of mist that hung in the freezing air. The man's car was parked in a lock-up on the lane, and he was looking forward to the last day of the working week. Before he could reach the vehicle, the man was stopped in his tracks by a strange sight.
The case of the Bible-quoting killer is a mystery which has puzzled the nation for nearly 30 years.
People were full of fear suddenly. Before that, I think they'd felt quite independent and free of that kind of worry. But Bible John entered a new element of fear into their lives.
Murder inquiries never close as far as we are concerned. And as new evidence comes to the surface, then we're duty bound to follow that evidence through and take it to its logical conclusion. And that's what's happened on this occasion. New evidence has come to the fore and we're following that evidence through.
Welcome to Season 9, Episode 1 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. This is part 1 of a 2-part case. The second installment will be available in 4 days. The man strained his eyes as he tried to comprehend what he saw in the gloom. There were no street lamps, and the only light came from the back of properties on Carmichael Place and buildings at the top of the laneway on Leadard Road. 90 yards from the entrance of the lane, there was an unexpected and awful discovery. The man had stumbled upon the naked body of a young woman. She was bruised and bloodied, lying on her back on the frozen ground at the door of a garage. The witness immediately raised the alarm. Time must have stood still as the man waited for investigators from Glasgow CID to arrive at the scene, although they did not take long to get there. Officers quickly cordoned off the entrances to the lane off Leadard Road and Overdale Street, while a tent was erected to preserve any evidence. Clearly a homicide victim, it was noted the woman was a white female aged somewhere between 20 and 30. It was hard to be more specific as extensive injuries distorted some of her facial features. She was exposed to the elements and had been left to die. Despite the wounds, there was not a significant amount of blood at the scene. Her brown shoulder-length hair was styled in a bob worn like many other women her age in the 1960s. The victim was naked apart from a single brown shoe. As officers searched the immediate area, another item was discovered nearby, which would later become relevant in the case. It was believed the victim was menstruating at the time of her death, as a sanitary pad was found close to her body. A post-mortem was performed later that evening and confirmed what many suspected. The unknown woman had been severely beaten. A line of deep bruising was noted on her neck, which supported the pathologist's conclusion that she had been strangled to death with some type of ligature. Based on the evidence available, the pathologist believed she had been killed around midnight. Back at the scene, forensic officers worked diligently. They documented the location, taking photographs and collecting anything that seemed out of place in the surroundings. Door-to-door inquiries in the quiet residential area would reveal nothing about the victim's identity. Meanwhile, the evening papers reported the shocking discovery. A senior officer told local journalists, "The body bore certain injuries, and we are treating it as a case of murder. The woman's identity is not yet known. She is of medium height with dark brown, short, wavy hair, and was wearing a wedding ring on the third finger of the right hand." Later that night, a man walked into a police station to report that his daughter was missing. John Wilson became concerned when he realized his daughter's appearance correlated with the description printed in the papers. Unfortunately, his intuition was right, and his worst fears were realized when he viewed the body. The victim was his daughter, 25-year-old Patricia Docker. Patricia was born on January 26, 1943. She was the only child of John Wilson, an Irish-born Royal Air Force engineer, and his wife Pauline, who was a nurse. As part of a military family, Patricia had moved around often before the family settled in Glasgow, Scotland. At 19, she married Alexander Docker, who, like her father, was also enrolled in the Royal Air Force. About a year after the ceremony, their son Alex was born in 1964. The family of three then packed up their belongings and moved to Cyprus, where Alexander was stationed. Sadly, their happiness wasn't to last. In the middle of 1967, Patricia and her young son returned to the UK and moved in with Patricia's parents in Glasgow. After her marriage had broken down, she needed the support of her family. Like her mother, Patricia found employment in the medical profession, and it was around this time that she began working as an auxiliary nurse at Mearnskirk Hospital in East Renfrewshire. The hospital was originally used to care for children suffering from tuberculosis and polio, but with the introduction of vaccines and the impact of the Second World War, it became a general hospital in 1959. Patricia worked nights while her mother looked after Patricia's son. She lived with her parents on the top floor of a three-story tenement built above retail units at 29 Langside Place. Patricia's mother worked opposite shifts, so it was rare that Patricia had free time to go out and enjoy herself without her son. On Thursday, February 22nd, Patricia told her parents she had plans to meet with colleagues at the Majestic Ballroom. Set up in the renovated Savoy Theatre on Hope Street, the Majestic, known to locals as the Magic Stick, was a popular dance hall that hosted live bands. It was cold that night, so Patricia put on a mustard yellow knitted dress and a thick grey duffel coat with a blue fur trim. After she slipped on her brown shoes and put her brown handbag over her shoulder, she walked out of the door of her parents' flat but never came home. The Majestic was over 3 miles from Patricia Docker's parents' flat, and her body was found just 300 yards from their front door. Working on the assumption that Patricia had been killed on her way home from a night out, the police appealed to anyone who was at the Majestic Ballroom on Thursday, February 22nd. Detective Chief Superintendent Tom Goodall, head of Glasgow CID, told reporters, "We are interested in interviewing every person who was at the dance hall, not only persons who may have seen this girl there. Any person who comes forward can be certain that their name and address and family circumstances will not be revealed." Investigators also wanted to speak with taxi drivers who had picked up a fare near Hope Street or dropped someone off near Carmichael Place. DCS Goodall also appealed for help finding Patricia's dress and coat. He said, "It is possible that this clothing may have been thrown away somewhere in the city. Anyone finding articles answering that description should contact us." Specialist police divers began searching the river which flowed south of the scene, and Queen's Park, just up the hill from the area, was also examined. Within a few hours of searching, the divers recovered a brown handbag and a brown shoe from the water. However, the rest of Patricia's clothing and her purse were still missing. A woman living in one of the houses next to the lane reported that she had heard someone screaming, "Let me go," at around midnight on the night Patricia was murdered. The pathologist had estimated that it was around this time that Patricia was killed. It took a few days for the police to track down Patricia's estranged husband, Alex, but he was quickly ruled out as a suspect because he was not in the area at the time of the murder. Another thing that hindered the investigation was the belief that Patricia had spent the last hours of her life at the Majestic Ballroom. On the third day of the inquiry, it emerged that she had gone to the Barrowland Ballroom in the East End of Glasgow. Rebuilt in 1960 following a fire 2 years earlier, Barrowlands had been a fixture on Gallowgate since the early 1930s and had a reputation for being a haunt for people labelled as undesirables. That Thursday was over 25's night. Detective Joe Jackson, who investigated Patricia Docker's murder, later said, "The Majestic was considered more upmarket at the time and Barrowlands less so. Patricia may have been worried that her parents would not be happy she was going there. She probably told them she was going to the Majestic to put their minds at rest and in case they tried to stop her going out." Despite Patricia's intention to simply go out and enjoy herself, there was a stigma surrounding married men and women who went to Barrowlands on Thursday nights. According to the Daily Record, some people called Thursdays "grab a granny night" and alleged that the people who went there were promiscuous. As the investigation unfolded, Detective Chief Superintendent Elphinstone Dalgleish, Deputy Head of Glasgow CID, announced that the police were seeking information regarding a white Ford Consul which had been seen on Carmichael Place at around 11:20 p.m. on the night of the murder. A female passenger was seen with a male driver. The police also wanted to trace a woman who was seen getting a lift in a Morris 1000 car from the Queen's Park entrance gate at around 11:10 p.m. The vehicle was seen driving in the direction of Langside Avenue. Although no description was given of any man seen in Patricia's company, Detective Chief Inspector George Brownie said that due to the severity of Patricia's injuries, a killer would most likely have been injured himself, perhaps sustaining cuts or bruises to his knuckles. The detective requested that anyone who noticed a man with those types of injuries or noted anything else suspicious report it immediately. Within weeks, news outlets lost interest in Patricia Docker's murder. The case seemed to be at a standstill, and there was nothing new to report. John and Pauline Wilson and Patricia's other loved ones were left to grieve and rebuild their lives. John and Pauline's 4-year-old grandson Alex moved away with his father and soon-to-be stepmother Anne before their marriage in April 1968. Eighteen months ticked by, and nothing of significance was discovered in relation to Patricia Docker's murder. The passage of time meant memories faded. Women once again felt comfortable going out at night to enjoy themselves at the Barrowland Ballroom. Unfortunately, that sense of safety was not to last. ...32-year-old Jemima MacDonald came from a large family. She was one of 7 children. Jemima had a close bond with her sisters, and they often went out dancing together. On Saturday, August 16th, 1969, Jemima asked her older sister Margaret to look after her 3 children, 11-year-old Elizabeth, 8-year-old Andrew, and 7-year-old Alan. Jemima, known to friends and family as Mima, curled her brown hair and put on a black pinafore dress over a white blouse that she paired with white shoes. After getting ready, she dropped the children off at her sister's flat. It was conveniently just down the hall of the tenement where they lived on McKeith Street near Bridgeton in Glasgow's East End. The last time the children saw their mother was when she kissed them goodbye. Before heading out the door, Jemima put on her brown woolen coat, which was closed with a belt, and picked up a large black patent leather handbag. Jemima's sister Margaret often stepped in to help with childcare when Jemima went out to dance, and she would always collect the children early the next day. On Sunday morning, however, Jemima had yet to return to the flat to shuffle the 3 sleepy youngsters across the hallway to their own home. After a while, Margaret thought she would pop over and rouse her sister from sleep and remind her to pick up the children. She knocked on Jemima's door and waited, but surprisingly, there was no reply. Not wanting to worry her niece and nephews and let on that she was concerned, Margaret told a white lie that she hoped was true. She suggested to the children that their mother had spent the night with a friend and would be back to collect them later that day. Deciding to contact other family members, Margaret informed them that Jemima was uncharacteristically absent. The family spent the afternoon looking for her. Although they did not find Jemima, their attention was drawn to some of the children living in the tenement. They were whispering about something they had seen in a derelict building just 2 doors down. By 10 a.m. on Monday, August 18th, Margaret had nowhere else to look, so she decided to see what the children were talking about. The 3-story tenement on 23 McKeith Street was unoccupied and run down. The windows were covered by unsightly sheets of cold corrugated iron to stop further damage and trespassers. It didn't deter some local children who saw the abandoned building as a fun place to sneak into. The ground floor was accessible through a door that had been pried open and remained unsecured, allowing the children to roam in and out as they pleased. Margaret had to navigate shards of broken glass and chunks of cement to get to the hallway and enter one of the old flats. She did not place much stock in the fanciful whisperings of children. That was until she saw something or someone in one of the rooms. The crumpled figure lay against the wall. They were not moving. Margaret's screams could be heard outside before she came running out and told bystanders to call the police. Investigators entered the dark, uninviting building and were confronted with the sight of Jemima MacDonald lying face down on the dusty ground. Her clothes were crudely bunched around her waist, and her once immaculately curled hair was matted with blood and debris. Her handbag and purse were missing. It was clear from the outset that there had been a violent attack. Jemima had been beaten, and bruises and lacerations on her face and scalp suggested that someone had held her by the hair while she desperately tried to escape. Her shoes and tights were found on the ground near her body. Her tights had been torn. Following a post-mortem, the pathologist concluded that her cause of death was ligature strangulation, and the killer likely used Jemima's own tights to kill her. A sexual assault examination was inconclusive, and Jemima was found to be menstruating, which explained the sanitary towel discovered close to her body. The time of death was estimated to be around 1 a.m. on Sunday, August 17th. Glasgow CID officers conducted a forensic search of the scene, but this proved difficult as several people had gone in and out of the building before the police arrived. Investigators hope that speaking to people who attended Barrowlands on Saturday, August 16th, would help them piece together Jemima MacDonald's last movements. Jemima had split up with the father of her children years prior, and she did not have a romantic partner at the time of her death. The Barrowland ballroom was less than a mile from her home. She often enjoyed evenings out and regularly attended the over 25s nights. Detective Chief Superintendent Tom Goodall appealed to anyone who saw Jemima that night. The detective had also been involved in the investigation into Patricia Docker's murder. Witnesses did come forward, and officers began to build a picture of Jemima's movements. After leaving her flat on McKeith Street, she stopped to get a portion of chips before queuing outside Barrowlands at around 9 p.m. The band was in full swing, and hundreds of people packed the dance floor until the music stopped shortly before midnight. Some of Jemima's friends recalled her dancing with a man they hadn't seen before. He was described as seeming out of place in the crowd. Most of the young men had their hair styled in a mod cut, or it was shaggy, similar to members of the Beatles or professional football player George Best. However, the man seen with Jemima had short cropped hair that was described as being reddish or fair. He had a slim build, aged between 25 and 35, and was quite tall. Some witnesses thought he was over 6 feet. The man was well-dressed in a dark suit and white shirt, and witnesses saw Jemima leaving with him once the Barrowland ballroom closed for the night. No one had caught his name or knew anything more about him besides his physical appearance. Jemima and the mystery man in the dark suit with cropped hair were seen walking along London Road 15 minutes later. One of her neighbours believed she saw Jemima talking to a man outside the derelict tenement just after 12:30 a.m. Jemima's handbag and purse were not recovered, and lead investigator DCS Goodall appealed to parents in the area to ask their children if they had seen it. the officer added. We have carried out an extensive search in the area but have come up with nothing yet. It is important to the inquiry that we find it. DCS Goodall was asked if there were any links to Patricia Docker's murder over a year earlier. He replied, there are one or two similarities between this case and the Docker murder, and we are bearing this in mind in our investigation. 1 week after Jemima McDonald's death, an identikit picture of the man seen with her was released to the public. A Glasgow CID spokesperson confirmed that following the release of the image, several helpful phone calls and statements were reported. In an effort to identify the man, investigators made the unprecedented decision to have an artist create an impression of the suspect. After obtaining permission from the Crown Office, Lennox Patterson, the Deputy Director of Glasgow School of Art, sketched a portrait of the fair-haired, well-dressed man the police were desperate to trace. The portrait was published in September. Soon after, dozens of people contacted the police to say they believe they recognised the man that had been sketched. Detective Superintendent James Binney told the correspondent with the Scotsman newspaper, "We have had a very good response from all over the country to the picture, and we are now sifting through all the information. This sketch seems to have caught the imagination of the public." Weeks passed, and maddeningly, even though thousands of people had been interviewed, the investigation was slowly grinding to a halt when detectives had exhausted all lines of inquiry. On October 22nd, 2 months after Jemima McDonald's murder, a sister Jean told the Scottish Daily Express that the family were putting up a cash reward for information. Jean said, "This £100 may just be enough to make someone come forward and give the police the vital clue they need. The money comes from myself, three sisters and three brothers. We know it will not bring Mima back, but if the man responsible is caught, it may save the life of some other poor woman." A week after that announcement was made, another family was torn apart when a woman was found murdered.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Archibald McIntyre left his home on Earl Street with his dog Smokey to go on a walk. They journeyed through the court at the back of the tenement in Scotstoun shortly before 7:30 a.m. on Friday, October 31st, 1969. Smokey pushed his nose to the ground, seemingly sniffing out somewhere to mark his territory, when he suddenly cocked his head to the side. He curiously bounded over to an indistinguishable pile in the corner of the court. Archibald followed the dog, expecting to pull Smokey away from some sort of unsavory mess he had become fixated on yet again. Archibald was taken aback when he got closer to Smokey's discovery. It was not discarded rubbish. It was a body. The woman, still and pale, lying on the ground, was pressed up against a wall of the building. Panicked, Archibald grabbed Smokey and rushed to a telephone box to get help as fast as his feet would carry him. The white, petite female, aged between 25 and 35, had dark brown hair in a short pixie cut. She was wearing black shoes, a black wool dress with gold buttons on the front, and a faux ocelot coat that had been pulled up over the upper half of her body. A dress had been torn, and upon closer inspection, the attending pathologist noted she had sustained significant head injuries. There was also evidence that the woman had desperately tried to defend herself. She kicked and thrashed on the ground, grass and mud wedged between her shoes and the soles of her feet. A deep bite marked her arm and beneath her armpit. Like both Patricia Docker and Jemima MacDonald, there was a used sanitary towel nearby. Knotted tightly around the victim's neck was a pair of tights. It appeared as though she had been strangled. It was later confirmed as her cause of death. A police caravan was set up close to the tenement court while forensic officers cordoned off the area and began photographing the scene. On the ground, close to the body, investigators found items that they believed had fallen out of the victim's handbag in the struggle, but they did not find the handbag. The man's cufflink was also collected. Perhaps it had been dislodged during the attack. Later that morning, a man knocked on the police caravan and told the officers he was worried about his wife, who had not come home after a night out. George Puttock told the officers that his partner, 29-year-old Helen, had gone dancing with her sister and he was anxious to find her. George later recalled, "In the morning, I looked out of the front window and saw a police caravan at the end of the road. I knew something had happened to Helen. Something just drove me on. I walked down the street towards the caravan and told a policeman my wife was missing. He asked me what she was wearing. When I told him, he went and brought another senior policeman back. I will never forget him putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, 'I'm sorry, son. Your wife has been murdered.' I just felt numb. You lose all your senses. The policeman walked me back to the house, but I wanted to look back into the alleyway where she was. They wouldn't let me." Helen met George Puttock while at a chance meeting visiting her brother in Surrey. They hit it off immediately and were married in January 1964. By all accounts, the couple had a good, steady relationship and were pleased when they became parents to two sons, David and Michael. Helen and her children dutifully followed her corporal husband to unfamiliar places when he was stationed abroad with the Royal Corps of Signals. Life in Germany was challenging, and Helen found it hard to adjust. Ultimately, she made the difficult decision to return to Scotland with their sons. She shared her mother's top floor flat on Earl Street, and missing his family, George tried to arrange for a transfer to be close to home. In October, George came to Glasgow while on leave and learned that Helen was enjoying a new pastime, going out dancing with her friends and sisters. George was unimpressed and felt it was not appropriate for a married woman to go out to ballrooms without her husband. However, Helen and her sister Jean assured him that it was just dancing. The sisters loved to go out and would dance for hours. Reluctantly, George decided it wasn't worth arguing anymore. He knew that Helen had been having a hard time and felt he could push her further away if he didn't give her some space. That night, George gave Helen 10 shillings so she could get a taxi home. That was the last time he saw his partner alive. George later said, "I had heard Glasgow was not a nice place and that the buses were very bad at night. I just wanted them to get home safely. That 10 bob I gave Jean was the worst 10 bob I have spent in my life. I didn't go to bed that night. By midnight, I was very worried she was still not back. Something just wasn't right. I knew she wouldn't do anything stupid because she loved the kids so much." Investigators were eager to speak with Jean Langford, Helen Puttock's older sister. She was the last known person to see her alive. Helen and Jean left their homes around 8:30 p.m. on Thursday, October 30th, 1969, and got a bus toward the Barrowland Ballroom where they met up with friends. According to Jean, she had met a man who introduced himself as John, and she spent the night dancing with him. Between songs, she learned very little about the man she was dancing with. She was, however, told that he lived with his brother in the Glasgow district of Castlemilk, and that he attended engineering classes in the city a few evenings a week. Jean described him as being around 6 feet tall, with bushy black hair and a thin build. She felt that he wasn't being entirely honest because he was likely a married man, something that was not unusual at Barrowlands on a Thursday night. The music from the live band filled the ballroom, and eventually very few people were left standing still, so there wasn't a great deal of conversation. Helen Puttock had also met a male dance partner, and when she introduced him to Jean, he said his name was John. Jean later told author Paul Harrison, "I don't believe either of them were called John. In fact, the man I was dancing with was the first to introduce himself to the others. When it came to Helen's partner, he seemed to pause for a second or two before giving his name as John. He seemed a bit apprehensive, and it was the only time I saw him look less than confident because he seemed so certain of himself in every other way." As the night drew to a close and people began filing out of the ballroom, the smell of sweat and cigarette smoke clung in the air. Jean, Helen and the two Johns stopped by the cigarette machine so Jean could buy a packet. After putting coins in the machine, she remembered that it hadn't been working. But before she could complain, the man Helen had been dancing with called for a manager and demanded she be given a refund. According to Jean, Helen's John spoke clearly and confidently, and the manager assured him that Jean could get her money back the next day. Stepping outside into the brisk autumn air, the man Jean had spent the night dancing with told them he had to get a bus back to Castlemilk. As he was leaving, Jean noticed the other John holding a pink piece of paper in his hand and showing it to Helen. Before she could see exactly what it was, John slipped it back into his pocket. Jean, Helen and John hailed a taxi and told the driver they wanted to go back to Scotston. During the 20-minute journey, Jean tried to engage John in conversation, but he was dismissive and didn't disclose much about himself. He said that he had been in foster care as a child and that he had a sister. Jean thought he said his surname was Sempelson or something similar. When she tried to make small talk by asking about his hobbies, John said that he enjoyed golf, but he wasn't as accomplished as a cousin of his who had previously got a hole in one. A passing remark he made about the ballroom later stood out. John told Jean that his father called those sorts of places dens of iniquity, referring to a blaze that had gutted Barrowlands years prior. He added, "The management set fire to this place to get the insurance money and done it up with the money they got." There were other comments he made that hinted towards a conservative or religious upbringing. He claimed that he preferred to pray than drink, and mentioned that according to the Bible, the punishment for adulterous women was being stoned to death. Even though the cab passed Helen Street first, John told the taxi driver to drop Jean off before them. Jean said that when she got out close to her home on Kelso Street, Helen was still in the taxi with John. Investigators were able to track down the taxi driver, who recalled dropping Helen and the man off at Earl Street at around 12:30 a.m. According to the driver, Helen got out first and the man paid the fare. The last thing he saw as he pulled away was Helen walking quickly down Earl Street and the man trailing close behind her. Investigators were quick to release the description of the man seen with Helen Puttock to the media. Quote, "Age between 25 and 30, 5 feet 10 to 6 feet tall, of medium build with light auburn reddish hair styled short and brushed to the right. He had blue-grey eyes, nice straight teeth with one tooth on the upper right jaw overlapping the next tooth, fine features, and is generally of smart modern appearance. He is dressed in a brownish flex single-breasted suit, the jacket of which has 3 or 4 buttons and high lapels. He has a knee-length brownish coat of tweed or gabardine, a light blue shirt and a dark tie with red diagonal stripes." Helen's sister Jean Langford also remembered a metal badge pinned to the lapel of John's jacket, that he wore a wristwatch with a broad strap, and that he smoked embassy-tipped cigarettes. Adding further details about the man seen with Helen, Detective Chief Superintendent Elphinstone Dalgleish went on to say, "He's thought to speak of being one of a family of two, a sister and himself. He may refer to a religious upbringing and make references to the Bible. He may also have talked of a strict upbringing with a severe parental attitude towards drink. He's quite well spoken, probably with a Glasgow accent, and does not appear to be engaged in heavy manual work. He may have marks on his face and hands of recent origin." The emphasis on the man's religious views led to him being dubbed Bible John by journalist John Quinn, who was writing for the Evening Times. This moniker was repeated over and over in the media coverage that followed, especially when the police began to consider that the murders of Patricia Docker, Jemima MacDonald, and Helen Puttock were all committed by the same man. Helen Puttock's badly beaten body was found close to her mother's home on Earl Street. Like Patricia Docker and Jemima MacDonald, Helen had been strangled after dancing at the Barrowland Ballroom. The description of Bible John provided by Helen's sister was very similar to the description of the man who was seen dancing with Jemima MacDonald. A new identikit picture was created and distributed, but the investigators were having trouble tracking down Helen's dance partner, known in the media as Castle Milk John. At a press conference at the police station, Helen's distraught husband, George, made an emotional appeal for the man to come forward. George hadn't been able to sleep properly since Helen's murder, and the first few days of the investigation involved eliminating him from the inquiry, so he had not had time to grieve the loss of his wife. Tears stung his swollen and red eyes as he said, "If the man called John from Castle Milk would just stop for 2 seconds to consider me and my 2 children, perhaps he would have a twinge of conscience and come to the aid of the police." George announced that he would be leaving the Signal Corps to focus on raising his sons. He added, "Helen doted on the children. I feel I must try to bring them up in the way she'd want me to. If I stayed in the army, I'd only be a weekend father." By late November, over 50 detectives were working on the inquiry, and the switchboard at City Police Headquarters was jammed as hundreds of people called in response to the identikit picture of Bible John. Hundreds of people were interviewed, with many more providing statements or suggestions about who the killer could be. Bible John was cited everywhere. Glasgow detectives even had to attend a private screening of Scottish TV programme Living 69 Style. Members of the public believed they had spotted the suspect in the audience. The fair-haired man caught on camera was eliminated from the inquiry, as were hundreds of other men who bore any resemblance to Bible John, a suspect who appeared on the front page of every national newspaper. In an effort to find the wanted man, detectives dressed in their best clothes and went undercover at Barrowlands and other dance halls on Thursday, Friday and Saturday nights. One detective remarked, "When this inquiry started, I could hardly dance a step. Now I get better every week." Detective Joe Jackson later added, "Our brief was to dance with customers and question them while showing nifty footwork. Even the ugly detectives proved popular dance partners, as the ladies felt safe with them. It was a dirty job, but someone had to do it. And I learned a pretty mean samba." Investigators spoke to tailors across the city and released images of the suit Bible John was said to be wearing on the night Helen Puttock was killed. Recent clergymen were also approached about members of their congregation on the chance that they recognised the description of Bible John as someone in their flock. Dentists in Glasgow were tasked with going through the records of all of their patients and compiling lists of men with the distinctive overlapping front teeth that Helen's sister Jean remembered seeing. Frustratingly, time was predominantly spent by officers chasing leads that ultimately went nowhere. It was the biggest manhunt in Scottish history, but despite their hard work, they were no closer to finding the killer. On December 27th, 1969, 18-year-old Henry Ackland presented himself at Temple Police Station. Surprisingly, he claimed to be Bible John. However, his confession was deemed untrue at Glasgow Central Police Court 2 days later. The teenager admitted that he had given the police false information and explained that he had got the idea to confess while he was walking around drunk. A police doctor told the court that Ackland's confession was the act of a man suffering from impulsive thoughts brought on by depression. He was fined £25. The following month, January 1970, a police spokesman told the Sunday Post that they feared Bible John would kill again. He said, "This is a serious and frightening possibility. Another woman may perhaps die because someone somewhere is withholding vital information. We feel certain that sometime on the night of the murder, the man we wish to interview was seen by someone. We have such a good description of him and such a good identikit picture of him that someone must recognize him. The impact of the attacks and the release of the identikit image was considerable. Suspicion fell on dozens of men who were accused of being Bible John. One man who looked almost identical to the image released by the police had been hassled by co-workers for his resemblance. The remarks were made in jest, but it became so intense that when the man's wife joined in what she thought was light taunting, the couple had a blazing row that ended their marriage. Some of the men who had been brought in for identity parades or questioning more than once had to be issued cards with the number of Chief Inspector George Lloyd because they kept being stopped by the police. In early February, investigators began canvassing golf courses across Scotland, hoping to find Bible John's cousin, the one he had boasted about in the taxi. Detective Sergeant Tom Valentine said, "We want to interview every golfer in Scotland who has had a hole in one. It's amazing how many of them there are. We are in the process of covering every golf course in Scotland, and police are cooperating with club secretaries. This is a vital clue. If we can find this cousin, it could lead us to Bible John. We feel sure that someone somewhere must have had a game with this relation of Bible John's. Someone saw him do a hole in one. He's told someone about it. Most golfers tell everyone about a hole in one." Suggesting that golf players ran in higher social circles, the detective added that he didn't want anyone to eliminate suspects because they seem to be pillars of society, adding, "The crime this man has committed is obviously completely out of character. He could strike again." The search for Bible John's cousin proved unsuccessful. Maybe the mention of the golfer was nothing more than fantasy, or thrown in as a deliberate red herring to disguise who he really was. Desperate for information regarding the murders, the press turned to the paranormal for answers. The Daily Record contacted a renowned Dutch psychic named Gerard Quessay, who had assisted investigators with missing person cases and murder inquiries across the globe. Accounts vary regarding Quessay's accuracy, but he provided the police with a map where he believed Bible John was living. Searches in the Govan area turned up no new information. Later that month, soldiers returning from Germany were interviewed following a conference between officers in the military's Special Investigation Branch and Glasgow CID. Army investigators provided a short list of five suspects who had been on leave in Glasgow at the time of the murders. But in turn, each of the men was ultimately eliminated from the inquiry. Furthermore, detectives were still trying to track down John number two, Castle Milk John, who was not suspected of any crime but was the only other witness who spent a considerable amount of time with the man suspected of killing Helen Puttock on the night of her death. Detective Superintendent Joe Beattie said in July 1970, "We want to renew our appeal to anyone who thinks they may have information about this man to get in touch with us. He may be able to give us invaluable clues as to the identity of Bible John." The following month, a new image of Bible John was released to the media. It was compiled using a system called PhotoFit, created by photographer Jack Penry. PhotoFit had never been used in Scotland up until this point, and a new composite of the prime suspect's face was made using sections of photographs of different features on a human face. The features were combined to resemble the description given by any witnesses. This image replaced the artist's impression that had been released early on in the investigation and resulted in a wider response from the public. Posters with the photo fit image were sent across Scotland and throughout major cities in England, including London, Manchester, and Leeds. In an interview with a reporter for the Sunday Mail in late August 1970, Detective Superintendent Joe Beattie said that a team of 20 investigators were still working on the case for 70 hours per week. The detective told the paper, "I'll never give up in my search for this man. In most cases, we only have a rough idea of what the suspect looks like. But because of the precise description given to us by Mrs. Puttock's sister, we know Bible John. He's out there, and we're determined to find him. If he walked in that door just now, I would know him right away. I've never seen him, but I know him as well as I know my own family." When asked if the case had taken a toll on him, the lead investigator replied, "I wouldn't say Bible John has become an obsession with me. We just can't afford to let go. For all we know, the pressure we're putting on him is preventing him from striking again." Bible John was one of the most notorious figures in Scotland in the 1970s. When Rangers Football Club won the Scottish League Cup final in October 1970, there were jokes that Bible John was found in the trophy room, as it had been 4 years since Rangers had beaten Celtic in the competition. The rivalry between the two clubs went deeper than typical firms. Sectarianism in Glasgow was most evident in the support for either team, with Celtic fans being mostly Catholic and Rangers fans being mostly Protestant. When Helen Puttock's sister Jean had asked Bible John if he supported Celtic or Rangers, he replied that he was agnostic before reciting a Bible verse. Coincidentally, while hunting Bible John, Detective Superintendent Joe Beattie was assigned to lead the investigation into the Ibrox disaster in January 1971. After the final whistle in a match between Rangers and Celtic at the Rangers football stadium, over 60 supporters leaving Ibrox Park were crushed to death, and a further 200 were injured. When the investigation into the disaster ended, Superintendent Beattie turned his focus back to the suspected serial killer. He told the Sunday People, "It's incredible that Bible John has eluded us. I'm positive that the man we're looking for comes from Glasgow or near Glasgow. He is polite, well-spoken, and of a middle-class background. He could still be in the area, yet he could be in the services and have been home on leave. But he must have lived with someone. I think someone is shielding him, possibly his mother. But the danger is he could strike again, and he could easily go back to Barrowlands. I don't think he is too religious, but a man with a normal, intelligent working knowledge of the Bible." Bible John struck fear into the hearts of many for years after Patricia Docker, Jemima MacDonald, and Helen Puttock were killed. Between February and May 1971, 65 women reported receiving phone calls from a man claiming to be the killer. The stranger's voice was sinister, and the words even more concerning. The caller coldly informed the women that he was going to strangle them. However, in June that year, a prank caller was arrested. 28-year-old Alexander McTaggart was brought to court and fined £100 for his actions. Procurator Fiscal Noel O'Brien told the court, "Intensive police inquiries were made, and they traced McTaggart to a Cumbernauld factory where they caught him with a telephone in his hand." McTaggart's counsel claimed that he was depressed after his wife had left him. It seemed as though the most wanted man in Scotland had disappeared off the face of the earth. That was until April 14, 1971. The partially buried body of a naked woman was found next to a railway line at Babcock and Wilcox Engineering Works in Renfrew. Her clothing had been cut from her body and strewn around the area. A note addressed to the police left inside an empty cigarette packet found nearby read, "I have killed that woman in cold blood." The note was signed, Bible John.
In the 60s, the Barrowland was the place to go dancing, to see and be seen. For the killer dubbed Bible John, it was the perfect hunting ground for victims. But the murders didn't stop the dancing. Women walked in fear, but after the killing, they walked in pairs.
It was undoubtedly one of the most sensational cases in the annals of crime in Scotland. In fact, I think I would go as far as to say it was probably the crime of the century, because it was the first time that we've had a hint of a serial killer at large. And of course, the name Bible John also captured the public imagination.
This is the end of the first episode of Season 9. The second instalment in this two-part case will be available in 4 days. Thank you for listening. A special thanks to our new Patreon producer, Pam, and all our patrons for their support. For more information on this episode, please see the show notes or visit our website, theywalkamonguspodcast.com.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.